What do you get when you put together Star Wars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Supernatural, and Stargate? Hi, my name is Marco and welcome to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. My guest this week is Sam Paisley. He's the author of the exciting sci-fi fantasy novel Winds of Change. It's the first book in the Elements of Time trilogy. He's also part of the Break-ins. It's a group of upcoming and newly published indie authors that also includes, among others, Andrew Watson and Brian Wilson, who were also guests on my channel. We talked about the process of finally finishing his novel after years of working on it, psychology and symbolism in fiction, challenges of being an indie author, and many more interesting topics. So, get comfortable, and let's get into this week's Storyline Session with Sam Paisley. Enjoy! Hi Sam, welcome to Storyline Sessions, how are you?
I'm good, Marco, how are you?
I'm doing good, got a cold, but I'm powering through, so we should be fine. Well, we could maybe start from the end of the year and we'll circle back to the beginning and the things that are the most important, your book. But the end of the year brought us some awards, obviously, because, you know, people are compiling their lists. People are talking about best reads of the 2023, and you've got quite a few nominations, if I'm not mistaken. I've seen the India Ink Awards. For me, what stood out, I didn't know that was a category, Best Friendship. And I think that's really awesome because I did get that from your book. So maybe you could start from there, from the nominations.
Yeah, for sure. I was lucky enough to be nominated for, I think, 70 Indie Ink Awards. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to remember them offhand, but something like Best Mentor, Side Character MVP, Best Cover, Best Friendship, a couple other ones. And I also actually won a Reviewer's Choice Award for from Book Nerd Action, which I didn't even know I was nominated for, which was quite the holiday gift to receive the email a few weeks back. So I won the sci-fi category, and my book, for anyone who hasn't read it, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but it's a science fantasy blend, so it could slot in either category. But I published in July, and this is my first ever book, so to get any nomination is huge. For anyone who even says they read it, let alone liked it, is an accomplishment as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, for sure, I can imagine, and congrats on the award. I think that's really interesting, seeing how many people who are in the space are getting the recognition so fast. You know, as you said, you published only just this July, and to get this far already, that's awesome. And even though you've published recently, your book's been long in the making. If I'm not mistaken, you said you're 9 years or something like that you've written it.
Yeah. And, end of 2014 is when I first started drafting, and then I published middle of 2023. So from inception to completion, it was about 9 full years. And then that's not the plan for future books. That was a decade of learning, a decade of learning the craft of writing, obviously the art of storytelling. And then also a good amount of time spent just on like how to publish, finding an editor, going through that process, cover artist, all of that stuff that can much more easily be truncated moving forward.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, it's a process I'm sure will be valuable for you moving forward. And looking at that, like, you've been working on it for 9 years, how did it feel when you first got it in the mail, the print copy? And how did that, I can imagine your pleasure seeing it first time live.
Yeah, it was, it's hard to explain, right? Something that you work on for so long and then having it in your hand. Although I personally have this bad habit of, once I achieve a goal, immediately moving on to the next one. So, there was like elation for a couple minutes, and then I was like, all right, now I got to figure out marketing, and now I got to figure out the next thing. So, lessons coming out of this year for me are to take a bit more pleasure and pride out of my accomplishments, even if it doesn't sell a copy. Just, you know, for anyone who's aspiring out there to write, to be able to commit and put together a story and the time and effort it takes to build one, it's a huge achievement in and of itself. But definitely, you know, every single time, like I said, somebody even says that they read it, let alone that they liked it. I mean, it's not a small book. It's a thick one, right? So for someone to take the time out of their day and of their lives to actually read it is super meaningful to me. Just as meaningful, as I would say, as actually having it in my hands.
For sure. And taking into consideration how big of a book it is, the pacing is not like something that's sluggish for me, at least. I think that's really important when you think about books this size. Of course, it's not the thing with, even though if a book has 200 pages, it can still be a slog. But, you know, taking into consideration a lot of people giving you advice. I mean, not you personally, but like you hear it constantly from editors, just trim it down. If you have like more than 500 pages, split it into two books, etc. And how much of it has been left on the cutting room floor? What was the integral version for this?
Yeah, so I would say, so the draft... Okay, to give you a bit of background, this is actually draft 7. I completely rewrote it 7 full times, well, 6 full times. The draft that I sent to my editor for the first round of editing, and she was wonderful. She has like 20 years in the industry and has went from traditional to indie to help authors like me, was 260,000 words. And basically she was like, my stance, and I told this to her, is like, I need to tell the story that I need to tell. I don't care if people feel it's too long. I need everything in here. And she's like, okay, here's my recommendations. And so I took that and basically cut out 35,000 words. I went through, and any word that wasn't necessary or idea that wasn't necessary, I was just completely objective. And I'm like, I can make this 10 word sentence, 5 words. Or I can make this, you know, instead of 3 paragraphs, I can turn it into 1. And I just condensed as much as possible. So it still ended up being about 230,000 words, give or take. Which means I was able to take about 15% out. But I didn't remove any ideas. So I'm not sure how far you've gotten through the book. Like I said, it's obviously a big one. But anyone who reads it can read it knowing that everything I wanted to be in there stayed in there. There wasn't anything that I removed because it was too long. And so far, I did also, out of advice from one of my friends, split it up into 2 parts internally within the book. So like, if you open up, you read part 1. So you can get that sense of, okay, there's a midpoint here. But none of the important ideas or concepts were left out.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as I said, I think the pacing doesn't feel like it's a huge book, even though like you could imagine that something demands a huge buildup. But I think that's visible. As you said, you didn't remove any necessary ideas, and I think that it shows. And for me, I've talked to a couple of other authors about this as well, that, for example, keeping the prologues in, even though a lot of editors say you don't need a prologue, agents won't pick it up, stuff like that. I think that when you truly care about your story, you do have a sense of what should be in there. Of course, you need help from editors to make it as polished as possible, but, you know, not everything has to be trimmed down.
The other thing that you mentioned right off the top, you know, something that's so integral to the story is the friendship between the two main characters and giving them both. So I'll kind of give everyone a shot of the cover, but these are equally the main characters, and giving them both enough time to have their own stories that are interwoven with one another while also really fleshing them out is absolutely integral to the story as a whole. Like, anyone who gets to the end would understand, like, oh yeah, you can't remove either of their stories. They are each half of the protagonist, essentially, in terms of, like, if you, metaphorically speaking, they're their own characters. But and as a result, I was trying to tell the story of two people, which just naturally makes it longer, right? You've got more POVs. There's a lot of other POVs that also exist from the side characters. But it was important to me, even in the build-up and the setup early on, that you really understood who these people were, so that you could see their journey and their growth and their character development. Because as the trilogy unfolds, they're both equally as important, and none of it could happen without both of them having their part in the story.
Yeah, that was a thing that I wanted to discuss, so I can jump to it. Writing multiple POVs, aside from 2 main characters, you have a lot more, you have pretty big cast of characters. Not all of them get their POV in writing, but there is a considerable size of people showing up. And what was that process like for you? Did you cut some POVs? Did someone just stood out as needing more room as you wrote it? How was that?
Yeah, I think that... So I'll answer the question kind of reverse. I didn't cut anything, and if I were to rewrite the story from a blank slate now, I'm not exactly sure how I would do it, although I think everyone who gets a POV is an important POV. Because I drafted 6 full times, I was really able to experiment with a lot of different writing. It's not the most efficient way to do it, and I wouldn't recommend someone write like 6 200,000 word books before publishing, but I had a really strong sense of the characters and the plot by the time I was actually doing the final draft. Everyone who has a POV has an important role overall in the story, and the way that I write is everything is centered around and reflected around a central theme. So Cooper and Reed, the main characters, are essentially mirrors and foils of each other, not in opposite mirrors, but like they are closely tied, related to one another, but also kind of fill in each other's gaps thematically. And then every other character reflects off of the themes that I'm trying to get across. So a central theme across this book and the trilogy as a whole will be destiny, personal responsibility, in this book in particular, what it means to grow up. So obviously the central antagonist, who has a POV, is a direct reflection against that, as well as the mentor characters, as well as the side characters. So every single scene from which we get someone's perspective builds out on those themes through their lens and view of the world. So if I were to write a POV of some random side character, even if it were just a one-off, I mean, there is, I'm not sure if you finished the book, I don't want to put you on the spot, but there's one section, like 2/3 of the way through the book, where you get a POV of 2 characters who have only ever been spoken about. It's like 3 pages long, but you get a POV of the idea of what sacrifice means and how it relates to duty and honor and responsibility. And it's an important POV plot-wise for what actually happens in the scene, but it's also important to be a reflection, first of all, of something that's going to happen later, but also of the themes that have been building. So that's kind of how I handle character writing in general. And if a character organically becomes important enough to give them a POV, that's how I'll approach it. And then I'm also not afraid to remove it if I write something that is really good and I like it and I'm like, you know what, it doesn't fit. I'll just kind of cut it out because it's about the story as a whole, not about, you know, each individual piece.
Yeah, for sure. I have to admit, I'm close to finishing it. I know the part you're referencing, okay. So I got to that part. I'm just short of finishing it. I was hoping I'll be there before we talk, but I've gotten enough to you know, recognize everything you're mentioning, and it really does fall into place. I have to say that it does feel like thought out when you first you're following Reed and Cooper, and when you get to the some shifts in the story, it does doesn't feel like abrupt. For me, that was important. You know, when you're reading something that has multiple POVs, for me, that's something that can be jarring. Just from out and over, you get some person and you're like, I was invested in this, but this came along quite well for me. So yeah.
And what I try to do really, really specifically is within each chapter is kind of, when whatever the POV is, it's thematic, like a shift, right? So let's say you have a chapter with, I'm not going to throw in a bunch of character names for people who haven't read it, but you've got a chapter with 3 different POVs. All of those POVs will relate to whatever the overarching theme of that chapter is. So there's a chapter midway through that is dealing with, the chapter is called Crucible, and it's dealing with, I'm not going to spoil things, but rebuilding yourself and putting the pieces of yourself back together and understanding kind of how you can change over time. And you've got really disparate characters that have nothing to do with one another yet in the story. Or not nothing, but haven't interacted with one another. But all of what's happening to them in the story at that time relates to that theme in that chapter. So when you're going from POV to POV, it feels like it's talking about the same thing. It's almost like you're watching an episode of TV with an A plot and a B plot, and, you know, they're dealing with the same issues. I tried to do that as much as possible.
Yeah, and the TV influences, and generally the movie influences, is visible, and you mentioned it yourself, you know, when people ask what would you compare it to, most of the influences you mentioned were movies and TV series. So it got that pace of something that you'd see on TV, and I can see that, like, layers of that fitting into that category. And if not mistaken, that there was, like, Stargate, Supernatural, Star Wars. So yeah, I think that's interesting, seeing, like, more and more authors in the sci-fi space and fantasy space being more aligned with the movies. Of course, being in the book community, it's interesting seeing those influences seep through, but not being, like, written just like a scenario, but something that influences, for me at least, the most the pace.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those are those three, and then Avatar: The Last Airbender, which you could probably tell from the magic system, were definitely the biggest inspirations. And for me, something that I've had to compete with a lot, especially with my editor, I mean, the number one comment I get on my writing is, oh, it's so cinematic. But my editor read it, she's like, look, it's great, but this is a book, there's a form to it and a function. So I've had to learn how to write. When I'm writing a scene, I'm really visualizing it. I often write at coffee shops, and I have to stop myself from, like, acting things out, like, with my body as I'm visualizing, like, the fight scenes, or, like, okay, what's Stinger gonna do here with her hands, or, you know, how's this power gonna be used? 'Cause I try to see it in my head and then put that onto the page, and it is inspired by TVs, movies, and the stories that I grew up with in that way.
And mentioning the magic system, how did that come about? What was your process of creating it?
Yeah, again, I wouldn't recommend my process for anyone else. For future books and different, I have a bunch of different unrelated series ideas. It's not going to be the process that I use, but basically, I have always been enamored with the Greek elements of air, fire, earth, water. And I knew I wanted to have a story that used those elements. And I knew that I wanted book one. I wanted it to be a trilogy completely arbitrarily. I just thought I liked trilogy. I do like trilogies, but... and I've now spent 10 years making it all make sense. But so I wanted the elemental magic system. And I wanted book one to end the way that book one ends. So I won't tell you exactly how it ends, but and then from there, and there's a certain mechanic in it, and from there I had to basically build out an entire world around it, which took the form of me writing in 2014. I took like a month and wrote like 200,000 words. It was complete trash, utter. If I ever become the next J.K. Rowling, I'll release it to the public and be like, look, you can start with garbage and still, you know, have a beloved, you know, series or book, or, you know, choose your author, Brandon Sanderson, Joe Abercrombie, whoever it is. But it was a lot of, what was really important to me was that the internal logic was completely consistent. And so I spent a long, long, long time thinking about how all of the pieces could fit together within the world, and uncovering how the keepers work and how that interrelates with the magic system. So for anyone watching who hasn't read it, the keepers are, like, you know, almost godlike beings that live in more or less a different adjacent realm to ours. Again, I won't go into too many spoilers, and how that magic system and the empathic weaponry interrelates to the mechanics of the elemental magic, and more importantly, how all of that drives the story, right? Because the actual magic system in and of itself isn't kind of latticed over the story, it is the story. And without the magic system in the series, the story itself doesn't happen, and the characters are almost irrelevant. And I wanted that to be absolutely vital to what was happening in the world. Again, it all comes back to the themes and building up from there, where if you remove one piece, if you take away characters' powers, the story won't make any sense, because the powers are what's driving the plot forward, but at the same time, the plot is driving the growth of the abilities in the powers. Hopefully that's not too cryptic. I think, you know, having read it, you probably understand what I'm saying. I don't want to give away too many spoilers within the story itself.
Yeah, for sure. But to tie into that, I saw it in your one of your Q&As that you mentioned that it's the story first and then characters fit the story. And for me, that was also interesting seeing because a lot of people do tend to go character first. And this was kind of a shift for me to see that you were tying it first the story and, as you said, the magic system, and then characters need to fit into that. And did you, like, when you started first thinking about the story, how much, like, changes for the way it's going to end at one point in the trilogy? Did you keep that? Did that stay the same along the way?
Basically, nothing has changed on a drastic scale. Things have grown significantly. So Cooper and Reed were always there. I'll name a couple characters without naming their roles, but Cooper and Reed were always there. Stinger was always there. Pax was always there. Sophoris was there from the beginning and then really became his own character over time. The kid was there very early on, and I got kind of lucky with that one, where as a character, it didn't make sense until he did. And then things like the Keepers grew into what they were over time, and that worked out really well. Claire was kind of an invention that I played around with in a short story completely unrelated to this universe, and I was like, oh, I'll build that out and build it in. So most things have grown and been added on over time as opposed to been removed, which is really nice. But because the inception of the story was very, and the magic system was pretty closely related to Cooper and Reed from the beginning, and everyone was a foil of them, it allowed me to basically keep most of those ideas really early on. And at the same time, I never added a character without that character having a purpose to drive everything else forward. There were a couple things in the early draft where it's like, this character or this mechanic or whatever is nothing, like it doesn't relate to anything, and I just threw it out. But for the most part, the big pillars have been there since basically the beginning, maybe draft two.
And you mentioned that you're plotting, you have like bullet points when you're planning out the arcs and stuff like that. Has that also been the way you're doing it? You also mentioned that there are some points when you like you can pump out 7,000 or 8,000 words in one sitting, so that's quite a feat. So how does like that change over time, especially now with your book being published, going on to the number two? How's that looking?
Yeah, so that's basically the process I'm going to use moving forward. I actually broke ground on book two this week. And what I've decided for book two is that I want to create as detailed of a chapter by chapter, scene by scene outline as possible. I'm about 6-7 chapters in, and it's already 5,000 words, so I imagine it's going to be like a 7,500-page document, but that's okay. Reason being, I figure out ideas by writing. And what that meant for book one was me writing like 6 full versions and then picking and choosing the ideas that I want. I think a more effective way to do that is to do it in bullet point form, see the story as a whole, and then start combining and cutting things out and moving things around and seeing the puzzle and kind of reading through it to understand. Once I've done that, if I have a really succinct roadmap and have put the pieces of the puzzle together, actually writing the words is fairly easy for me once I've kind of built the muscle and gotten into it. And again, that's an outcropping of spending probably 3,000 to 5,000 hours writing over the last decade, right? Like really putting those hours in. So for me, compartmentalizing the idea generation versus the act of writing versus the act of editing, and doing it in a succinct order is a bit painful, but far more efficient, right? The work up front, it's like measuring twice and cutting once. I'm gonna get it right the first time, so instead of it taking 9 years, it might take 8 months or 12 or 16 months or whatever it is.
And how do you know when you're finished with a scene or with a chapter? What is it for you? Like, you can, of course, as many of us, polish it forever, but when do you say, okay, this is enough, at least for now?
Yeah, I think the when I'm drafting, I don't self-edit. I just put it down on the page, and I'm like, I'll come back to it later. It's just get something down. So typically, like, an actual end of a scene or a chapter will usually kind of just happen. It whatever the drama or conflict is within that scene is ends, and typically I like to end a chapter or a scene on some sort of, not cliffhanger, but like not a full resolution. It's like you want to keep reading the next thing. As far as the actual story as a whole, when do I know I'm done? With this first one, it was just, I reached the point where I was like, all right, I can edit this until literally forever. It's not worth it anymore for the marginal return. I'd given it to a bunch of beta readers. I'd given it to friends. I'd given it to family. I'd given it to a professional editor. For me, what I was looking for was, before I gave it to the editor, was the story and the writing at a point where I was confident with it. Had I gotten enough feedback to know, first of all, what feedback to listen to and what feedback not to listen to? You could give it to someone who's just not a genre reader and be like, ah, I couldn't get past chapter one. It's like, that's okay. You only read, you know, thriller books or John Grisham books. This isn't for you. I'm okay with that. Versus someone who's in genre who's like, I didn't like X, Y, Z. So I'd gotten enough feedback to know, okay, the quality of the writing is fine. I've read this book myself 20 times. It can't get any better. Send it to a professional editor. Once I did that, my editor, I got two passes. So I gave her the first draft. She gave it back to me. Then I could give it back to her. And once you're paying for an editor, it really kind of gets you to that commit level where it's like, unless something's drastic, I don't particularly want to make massive changes because I'm putting my own money in this. So you have to decide if you're at that point and if that's something that you want to do. For me, part of paying was also me just pushing myself to put it out to the world. Because I could have kept editing forever, frankly. I could have kept chipping at the edges and trying to make this better or that better. But after 10 years, I was like, all right, I've put the work in. I've had this edited properly. I've gotten the feedback that I need. It's important for me now to get this out into the world and move on to the next project. Moving forward, I think I'll follow a similar system, but again, on a shorter period of time. So basically drafting, edit it myself to give it, you know, the proper polish, get some good feedback on it. I now am far more connected and have a bigger community in the writing world than I did before. So get other writers, get ARC readers, get people like yourself, you know, take a look at it before it's public, go to professional editor, and then get out into the world. And I think for anyone who's starting this journey, what you're going to find is just kind of keep stumbling forward. You'll figure out what steps work, and every single time it'll get easier and shorter, because I certainly don't know what I'm doing, and that seems to be the consensus of all the other indie authors that I've spoken to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it amounts over time to something greater. And for me, like, as you said, you're now far more connected. But at the start, for me, what's interesting, seeing how people get to, like, better readers and feedback aside from their close friends or the community. And how did you, like, go about acquiring those feedbacks and, like, sorting? You said you far more value the people who are genre readers. But, like, how did you react to first negative feedback? How was that for you? I can imagine that can't be nice.
Yeah, well, it's funny. So when I first started writing, I wrote that first draft in like a month, and I'm not even exaggerating. It is pure garbage, unreadable. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It has like multiple head hops within POVs within like one scene, unreadable. So I went to, obviously I was 23. I thought I was like, oh, I wrote a novel in a month. I'm the greatest writer who's ever lived. I went to a writing course at University of Toronto, near where I live, and it was workshop based, and I quickly learned I had no idea what I was doing. So submitted some of my work, and some of these people that have, there was like seven of us, we became very, very close. They're you know, friends of mine, writers, some of them published writers, some of them not. Early on was just getting very, very honest, critical, but kind feedback. And so I became very adept at taking feedback very early on and just you know, sharing my stuff and saying, I don't care what your feedback is, tell me, like, if it's harsh, if it's whatever. And so I kind of earned my stripes young in that process when my writing was in fact quite poor, which was good, right? Like, you don't want to have bad writing and people tell you it's great and then never learn from it. I'm by no means Shakespeare now, but I know I'm better than I was. So getting that feedback early on was super helpful and super valuable. And it was coming from people who I knew, number one, they were good writers because I've read their work. And number two, they wanted the best for me. So it takes a lot of the sting out of it too. So kind of as I moved forward, I would give my writing to, it's difficult when you give writing or anything to friends because friends are always going to want to be nice. But if you can find people who can give you really honest feedback, it's always useful. And then basically the policy that I adopted was if you hear it twice or more, there's probably a kernel of truth to it. So, you know, one person reads it and they're like, this is garbage, I hate it. But 99 other people are like, no, super solid, it's probably good. If you're giving it to 5 people and they're all giving you the same feedback of, oh, it's really slow in this part, or this character doesn't make sense to me or whatever, that's probably feedback worth taking. How you use that feedback is up to you, but it's worthwhile listening when multiple people are telling you the same thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you mentioned the people, your peers from the community, people who are also writers. How was that experience getting into the community? We've seen increasingly more so in the community, people bundling up together for promotions, putting their books in a bundle for promotion. You did that as well. And generally supporting each other. For me, that was really great to see as someone who's quite new to the community as well. How was that feeling for you? You know, you went to workshops and everything like that, but when you branched out online, social media, stuff like that, how was that so far?
Yeah, it's been amazing. I'm not a social media person. I only got Instagram to promote the book, and everyone's telling me to get on Twitter. Like, I've avoided all social media like the plague since I was like 15 years old. But everyone's been incredibly welcoming. And you'll reach out to people who have 10,000, 20,000 followers, maybe more, and they're super nice. And they might not have time to read your book, because obviously there's like thousands of indie writers reaching out to them, but everyone's really kind. I've been able to fall into a couple different groups of people who are at similar stages as I am, so we keep each other going. You know, we were messaging each other, have you got a sale in the last week? No, me neither. And it keeps your head on straight, right? Because it can get really isolating, not knowing what baseline is, not knowing what's normal and what's not normal. And you know, I'm in a group right now, we call ourselves the Break-Ins. Brian Wilson, who I know you've interviewed, is there. Rob Lee, a bunch of other people who with books that are about to come out that I'm happy to introduce you to, who are all amazing people. And it's incredible to see like how much everyone's willing to help each other and support each other. And truly, the indie community, everyone just wants everyone to succeed, because there's no lack of readers. There's no lack of people who want to enjoy books. And typically speaking, we can all lift each other up, which is amazing, right? You're dealing in a non-zero sum game, and everyone can just really support each other. So I would say anyone who is out there, who's looking to write or looking to get into indie publishing or self-publishing, just start reaching out to people, because I have yet to meet anyone who wasn't nice. People might not have time, that's totally normal, but no one's going to blow you off intentionally.
Yeah, that's awesome, really. I have the same feeling. And for me, what's also interesting, you mentioned the social media, people with a bunch of followers, I feel that in this community, the numbers don't have to be super high for you to have a community, you know, to have people who are really responding to your work, whatever it may be, opposed to some other industries and types of work where people just want to pile on the numbers. But for example, Zamil Akhtar, who I recently had on, he doesn't have like hundreds of thousands of people, but he had a super successful Kickstarter for his deluxe edition, which was a great success. And for me, that was also one of the examples that you can see that it's enough to just have people invested and not worry about some super large numbers.
Absolutely. And was that the one where he did the 115,000 Kickstarter?
Yeah, that's the one, the Gunmetal Gods.
incredible. Yeah. Congratulations to him. But absolutely. I mean, I don't have a huge following, but it's amazing to see. Like, I was able to go to my high school to give a speech on writing a few weeks back. You know, posted a picture of it, and you know, 100 or so people liked it, and obviously that had impact. And I only have, like, on Instagram, like, let's say 450 followers, but you can see that people really engage with you, and you know, whether you have 100 followers or 10,000 followers, you can find a niche. You can find people who are interested in what you're interested in. And what's really cool about the indie community is that there's so much crossover that you can find people who are, let's say, interested in my book, and then I can be like, well, this other book is, like, similar to my book, and then that author can be like, well, these other books are similar to mine, and all of a sudden you can find this unending list of things that you are almost definitely going to enjoy, made by people who know each other and you can connect with really easily.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned going to the school. I was also going to ask you about that. How did that come about? But for me, that was super cool. You know, seeing that, I can imagine that it was really a great experience.
Yeah, I mean, so you've read my book, so you know, obviously, high school has a special place in my heart. It's not hidden there, but I was really lucky in high school. I just had an incredible experience, and everyone in my school and my grade was amazing. And I know that's pretty rare. But when I published, the principal actually reached out and was like, oh my God, we're so proud of you. Like, you know, will you come sign copies? Will you come talk to the students, to the English class, the writer's craft class? And I, of course, I jumped at that opportunity. So it was incredibly meaningful to me, and something that is particularly meaningful to me. Part of the reason I started writing, so when I was coming out of university, I was deciding what I wanted to do with my career. If I wanted to go into film, I wanted to be a teacher. I actually wanted to be a high school English teacher. I decided to go into the corporate world and then use my free time to work on creative projects. But which I'm happy with that decision, for anyone who's curious. But I so strongly believe in the power of storytelling and the power of the power that stories have to teach us lessons about who we are and how to interpret the world and who we should be. Something that is a dream of mine down the line, whether it's 5 years, 40 years, who knows. But part of the impetus for writing this book was to write something that kids and adults, you know, let's say YA, but you could be 30, you could be 60 and read the book, enjoy the book, have a really fun, interesting read, but at the same time, something that has a lot of levels and a lot of depth to it that can be deeply interpreted and used as a tool, let's say in high school English, to really teach people how to read literature and interpret themes and interpret archetypes and all of those things. And as a quick example, and I didn't get to talk about this when I was there in a lot of detail, but, you know, Cooper, this one, is designed to be a Peter Pan archetype, right? And through that, through his abilities, through his journey, through his arc, through what happens kind of in book 1, 2, and 3, be a deep and meaningful reflection on what it means to grow up and what it means to not grow up and what those consequences have. And, you know, the start of the story, he's conflicted about not wanting to leave high school, which is obviously metaphorically a stepping ground into adulthood. And you know, if you look at things like Peter Pan, the boy who never grows up, like, do you want to be the king of Neverland, or do you want to be an adult and actually, you know, have a family? And, you know, all of those different things are archetypal in the story, but I try to layer that underneath a really fun story that anyone could read at any time. So going back and talking to my high school, let's kind of take the roundabout answer to your question, was super duper meaningful, and it's something that I hope to be able to do more with this series.
Yeah, and hearing you talk about that, like the meaning in books and whether it's YA or adult fiction, for me that's super like interesting, talking about how we can tell meaningful stories through genre fiction, and what's like increasingly maybe visible to people as it wasn't like just a few years ago. And for me, that's really important because I had the opportunity to talk to people who don't like genre fiction, don't like reading anything that's fiction. And like they just write it off like it's something that's like just to pass your time, etc. And I think that it's really meaningful talking about these topics and how you can say something meaningful through fiction. And that also ties into something that's also interesting. I read that you like reading, when we were on the topic nonfiction, you like reading psychology. And I can imagine that ties into the topics you've mentioned, like duality, growing up, like the mirroring of the characters. And did you like intentionally let that theme seep in, or was it something that's just like constantly a duality for you when you read nonfiction and fiction?
Yeah, I think that it's definitely, well, it's both intentional and non-intentional. So part of, probably part of the reason that I like fiction is because I do also like psychology. And, you know, if you look at particularly Carl Jung and his depth and understanding of archetypes are obviously related to fiction. And to me, those things are fundamentally related to one another. And so an understanding of behavior and psychology obviously helps me write characters in a way that is true to how we would think a person would act or feel in that situation. And vice versa, understanding psychology also helps me understand and interpret literature and fiction, right? And those two, to me, they link up really, really closely. And if you look at something like psychoanalysis, which would be kind of most closely related to things like dream analysis. You know, people think that dreams are just random images that come up in your head, but there's a lot of evidence and research and to point to the fact that you can interpret dreams. They have a logic, they have a consistency in a way that just isn't pure rational logic. But if you are adept at interpreting dreams, you can often interpret significant meaning about what's going on in your brain that might not appear in your everyday conscious, right? And I think it was Jung, but I don't want to misappropriate, but some ingenious psychologist said that dreams are actually the birthplace of ideas, and it's where your brain can basically act out infinite different test out infinite different stories. Well, what if I jumped off a bridge? Well, what if I did this with no real consequence? Which is basically what you're doing every single day. That's what thinking is. That's what imagining is, right? And so, you know, dreams and psychology and archetypes, they are direct analogs, as far as I'm concerned, to literature and fiction. And I think, typically speaking, I have no basis of evidence. Everything else I have read, I have researched. This is just my own theorizing. But I think people who are naturally drawn to fiction and naturally drawn to let's say, even genre fiction, probably have a natural affinity to understanding at least psychoanalysis and things like dream analysis and the archetypes and how they fit into our minds. But that's just me guessing based on solely my own bias.
Yeah, but it's really interesting to think about. You know, I think that makes a lot of sense. And have you pulled some of your parts of your book from your dreams?
Not particularly. Again, the story, I really tried to make it, every part of it, its own thing and not influence it from something I really wanted in there. My dreams, however, are, I guess the answer is yes, because obviously if it's in my head, it's going to be in the book somewhere. But my dreams are often of like strangely epic scale. I'm often either on some adventure or trying to survive something. So I would imagine in some way that has inspired something in the book, but it's not like I dreamt up this idea that was super book relevant and then put it in the book.
And you mentioned one of the characters that you pulled out from a short story and like worked around to make her fit the Elements of Time. And what else have you written? You know, because you've published this one book so far, but how much of like free time you have for other work? Did you write some other short fiction? How that ties into the main series, if it does at any point?
Yeah. So basically, this book one was my main writing focus of the last decade, and like I said, I just broke ground on book two. I'm a very like I need to finish one project type of guy. I couldn't flip between them, just the ideas wouldn't flow as naturally. I've tried it before, it doesn't work so well. But I do have one, two, three, four other standalone novel ideas, one of which is semi-related to this universe, but it doesn't take place within the story at all. I actually referenced that character in the book, but it's like such a like one line one-off thing that you'd have to read both very carefully to see the connection. But those are projects that I'll likely do either after book two or after book three. And one of them is hard sci-fi, the other three are fantasy. But no, like my main focus in writing has been on this series, and I think as life gets busier, it's probably going to be the same. Just try to finish one project and get it out to the world.
For sure. But you also mentioned that you would like to get an audiobook out. So is there some progress on that front?
Yeah, that's the 2024. So 2024, my main goals are, I'd like to get an audiobook out because you've read it. I think it would serve really well as an audiobook. It's very cinematic, and I think that would do well as an audiobook. I've started doing research on it, but I haven't started actually recording or hired anyone yet. Kind of deciding if I want to hire or if I want to do it myself. I also was thinking about dropping a novella if I have the time, but in this world, but I think that would either be a novella or going full force on book two. So I have to decide which one is more feasible. I don't think I could do both just with everything that I know is coming up on my end with work. So those are my main 2024 projects for sure.
And are you more of a reader or a listener when it comes to books?
Probably even split. It's easier for me to find time to listen to books because I can do it while doing a lot of different chores. So you can double up on, you know, if I'm washing dishes or cleaning the house or folding laundry or walking the dog or whatever, shoveling snow because I live in Canada. But ideally, I like to have the book in my hand and read through it. So probably an even split. If I had more free time, it would be more physical reading.
And mentioning the book in your hands, you've showed us the cover a couple of times. What was the process on that? I mean, it's a great cover. It really is evocative of the scenes in the book. And was that process as like convoluted as writing it, or it come maybe more easily?
Yeah, so basically, this is actually the final design of the second design of the book. And my designer, his name's Jeff Brown. He did a wraparound cover. I highly recommend him. He is absolutely incredible. It was a much easier process than the actual writing. It took about maybe 2 months, but that had more to do with Jeff is a very busy guy. So like from when I booked him to when I actually started working with him. But basically the process for my cover design with Jeff was we sat down, I told him a little bit about the book, and he actually started sketching in front of me designs. And we kind of talked through like, what are some elements that you want on the cover? Who are the characters? What's the vibe you're going for? All that kind of stuff. So the very first cover we designed looked really good on sketch and did not turn out when he was fully fleshed out. It basically was like Hooper and Reed, full front profile with like Pax's mask behind them. And it was cluttered and it wasn't what we were looking for. And he actually just trashed it. And we then resketched out the entire cover again. And he was like, I don't charge you any money until you're happy with the cover. So he's an absolute, you know, gem of a person to work with. And then we just iterated on the cover, and he would send me like, how does this look? And I'm like, can you make Cooper look a bit older and more athletic? He's looking too slim. Change this detail here. Pax looks like Voldemort or something, like change up XYZ. And so we just tweaked, you know, show a bit more destruction here. Can we add light coming from there? And it was just a really easy back and forth where I gave feedback, and then kind of on the fly, he would make changes and then touch it up. So, I'm super happy with the cover. I think it gets across everything it needs to get across. I don't know. Are you approximately like what percentage or what chapter are you on?
Like 80-85% through, so I'm really close to the end, like 600 something pages.
Okay, so you're probably about to get to more or less where the scene of the actual cover takes place. And yeah, so it was a really really easy and good process, and a product that I absolutely love. So Jeff Brown is his name. He does, I think, mostly fantasy sci-fi. And I would say for anyone, again, who's in this process, your cover is your number one marketing tool. It's going to tell a reader what the book's about, what the genre is, what the feeling they're going to get is, what's involved with it. And so give it some time. If you have the time and the funds to invest in, you can often find people who are artists who are not that expensive, but you're better off getting something that, if you're going to invest anywhere, put it in the cover, because it will be your number one tool.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, increasingly more so we can see that don't judge a book by its cover is no longer relevant.
Yeah.
And when you look like, when you scroll through book fronts, and people do, like, you can see that some of the people still don't get that, and for me it's a shame, that because I'm sure I've missed some great books just because I wasn't feeling the cover. So yeah, and the symbols and the things inside the book, you don't have like too many illustrations, stuff like that. You don't have like a huge map, but some tidbits that you did insert, how did those come about?
Yeah, so basically let me see if I can find an example. So okay, a little bit of a preview for you. This is the first ever showing of this, but I do and will have merch coming out. So nice. This is my test shirt. This is the symbol that Marco's referring to, and this is wrong. The top line's supposed to be blue, but that's the symbol. And basically, what this symbol denotes is the white swirl is air, the red one is fire, the top line, which is supposed to be blue, is water, and the bottom line is black, which is earth. And basically, the iteration of that symbol, it started off by saying I wanted to have a symbol that was representative of the book and within the book, and I cannot draw. So it had to be something that I could feasibly draw so that I could explain to people. But moreover, there's a lot that went into that symbol. So, I'll bring it up on the actual book cover so you can, that's a big example. Let me get my bookmark, which is a bit clearer. But basically the symbol within the book and in the series, it represents all four elements. Obviously the four elements, as we've discussed in this conversation, are a massive part of the actual magic system itself. The plot, the characters, all of those things. It will be no surprise if you're reading the book and then if you've seen the cover and kind of put two and two together that Cooper and Reed take part in the system. And the interplay between all the elements is really important. So within the symbol itself, there's a reason for all of the colors, the icons, the positioning, everything. So... And actually, speaking about Jeff, this was like an early iteration on the back of the bookmark of the cover compared to the final, so you can see like some of the work. But the positioning of air and fire, so first of all, they are rounded, they're spirals, they're not straight. And the reason for that is because they are ephemeral in their nature, right? You can't capture air, you can't capture fire, they have no true form. So I wanted to give them something that was flexible, that showed movement to it. Thematically speaking, air is on top and the highest point, and fire is the lowest point, which blends into a lot of the underlying themes, which are around Judeo-Christian values and the idea of heaven and hell and all of those things. It's not by any means a religious book in any sense, but the underlying themes of heaven and hell and all those kinds of things, the soul and whatnot. So white representing heaven, red representing hell, are the highest and lowest points on the symbol. They come all of the four pieces, hopefully it focuses, come close together, but they never touch in the center. They overlap kind of at different parts, but they never actually touch in the center. With water here and earth there being sharper and harder symbols, will also, because they are physical, right? Water doesn't have a form, but you can still touch it. And contain it, and same with earth, obviously, earth being the absolute most physical of the four. Similarly, they're under and touching their opposites, right? So earth is under air, water is under fire, they're connected to each other, but they're also equal and opposite. So in the book, I pair air and fire together, and earth and water together later in the series. The symbol as a whole is a symbol in the language of the keepers, which means its own thing. So within the story, each individual symbol, symbology, colorology, has a really big impact in the story. And I wanted something that could kind of showcase that. And those symbols appear throughout the story for a number of different reasons. But also something that, you know, similar to the Deathly Hallows or whatnot, was representative of the story as a whole, but had a lot of meaning and thought kind of given to it.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I mean, like hearing it, does this thought out, it's really cool seeing how much thought you put into it, and it really does make sense. And I think that's really something that's both great for the story and, as you said, Sholens, the merch, because it does work. Like, it's really a cool visual thing. How did that come about? Like, did you know from the start you were going this route as well, or was it something that just like came about recently?
In terms of the symbol or the merch?
No, the merch.
I've always wanted to do merch. Like, I don't think there's anything cooler than if I were to see someone walking down the street with like something that I made on it. And you know, if you walk into whatever, a toy store, an EB Games or what have you, and you see like the whole Harry Potter section, obviously just from a business and branding standpoint, that would be fantastic if I were able to do that as well. But I think it also gives people who are like, I am part of, you know, I get really into whether it's series or what have you, and I know there are a lot of people out there and people who want to show their support and people who want to represent the things that they really love. So, you know, definitely would want to give people that if they love my book and be like, hey, here's, you know, you've read it, so here's a plushie of Icarus or a plushie of these Spritas or whatnot. And it's something like, I want to be able to, as much as I want to write and create a world, I want to create that world outside. Like, there's nothing cooler as a kid than if you get like a cool, like a lightsaber, right? For Christmas or for Hanukkah or whatever. And to be able to do that and build this world further than just in the pages of a book would be a dream come true for me, because it means that people are even more immersed in something that I made.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I can see it really working. And one more thing is also the signed copies of your book, that they go well with the bookmarks. And how do you go about that? I know a lot of authors have some issues with shipping, and that can get in the way.
Yeah, so right now, you can go to my website, which is elementsoftime.ca, or you can find me on Instagram and then link to the website and order a signed copy. Basically,
we'll put it in the description.
Yeah, oh, thank you. And I just ship them straight from wherever I am. So I'm in Toronto, but and right now I'm just doing shipping in Canada and the US because of cost, but I'm hoping to figure out a way that's more efficient. Literally, like, there's a pile of books back there. If someone orders, I'll sign it and mail it off to them. And it's just the cost of the book plus a flat shipping fee, wherever you are in Canada or the US. And then I'm hoping to be able to figure out a way to find a distributor or something where I can do that more efficiently and bring the cost down, but also distribute wider. I have sent books to Germany, to Spain, to whatever, but that's obviously a bit more cost prohibitive. So if there's any listeners out there who want one, they can message me directly and we can figure out something that works. Like, my priority is getting books in people's hands. If I can do it at cost, I'm happy to do that. But, like, obviously, if it's going to cost me like $150 to ship a book, it becomes more difficult.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I hope it works out. I know it can be a pain, but hopefully you'll figure out a way. And before I let you go, I would like to hear what were some of your favorite things 2023, be it books, movies, games, whatever comes to mind.
Yeah, 2023 was a really big year for me. So I'll finish with what was my favorite thing of the year. But in 2023, I left a job. I started a new job. I got laid off. I was job hunting throughout the summer, found a new job, released my book, obviously very, very busy. My sister got married. I attended like 8 weddings. I was a groomsman in 4, but the biggest thing that happened to me this year was I actually proposed in June and I got married in October. I'm obliged, but it is also true to say that my wedding was definitely the highlight of the year for me, which is crazy because I spent a decade writing a book and published it, and it still wasn't the biggest thing to happen for me this year. But yeah, really, really big year. And I have to say, just I'm incredibly grateful for everything that's happened to me this year. It was absolutely wonderful.
I mean, that's an awesome note to end on. Congrats for everything, and it's really great to hear that, and hopefully 2024 will be even better. So yeah, thank you, Sam, for coming on to Storyline Sessions. I'm looking forward to book 2 and everything that comes after that, and we'll be keeping an eye out for sure.
Thank you, Marco. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find Sam on his website and Instagram. I'll link both in the description. If you're interested in topics of creative writing and storytelling in any kind of media, keep following Storyline Sessions, both here and on Instagram. My name is Marco, and I'll see you next week. Keep creating stories.